Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. We are very glad you could join us today, and I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator. We will be providing some instructions as we go along for the benefit of our first-timers, and we want you to relax and participate with us. Now, if you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on your participants' panel, and either Ava Jean or Lori will try to help you via the chat. And once you have been helped, please lower your hand. Now, if you were with us last time, you may recall that Doc Lumpkins was here to speak about the SIRA, and he mentioned that they were working with the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration on the National Mitigation Framework, which was an excellent segue since we had already planned today's program. We hope to learn more about the mitigation framework today and also the current status of the National Flood Insurance Program reauthorization and program reform. There are several related links on today's background page that you can check out later if you haven't already, including one to a very good Senate hearing on the NFIP that occurred earlier this month. Now, first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program, and also ask you not to send any private chat messages to the speaker or host, as we will be busy with the presentation. We are making a recording of the program, which should be available later this afternoon, along with the slides. And a text transcript will be posted early next week. And if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready. Now, it is my great pleasure to welcome back David L. Miller, Associate Administrator of the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration. He previously served as the Administrator for the Iowa Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And our last program with David was a little over 2 years ago after the major flooding event there, and you can find that program in our archives. And speaking of mitigation, Iowa was one of only 12 states to have an approved enhanced state hazard mitigation plan, which you may know allows for increased mitigation funding under the HMGP. And during his tenure with the state, David was responsible for the execution of hazard mitigation grant funds in excess of $350 million. Please see today's background page for further biographical information. Now, welcome back, David. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today, and I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy. Good afternoon or good morning, everybody. Really want to talk about two things today, and Amy kind of outlined that. We want to first talk about mitigation and the role that it plays in FEMA and throughout the nation, and then we're going to talk about the National Flood Insurance Program. Its current status, as Amy mentioned, we're going through reauthorization right now, but probably the thing that people want to talk about most is the reform effort, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. The first slide depicts, you know, for some of us that have been around emergency management for a long time, we used to see a circular slide that really talked about mitigation as the beginning of a circular process where we did mitigation and preparedness. Depending on your point of view, you had one in front of the other. But then we did disaster response and recovery and came back to mitigation. I think as we look at it now, what we're really trying to emphasize is that mitigation is a thread that pulls through everything we do in emergency management. And when we look at it relative to the disaster, we do a lot of stuff pre-disaster, during the preparedness phase, as we're getting ready, as we're anticipating what may happen, as we're trying to lessen the effects of future disasters, and looking at our threat analysis. To the time when we are actually in response, there are other opportunities for mitigation in response, or how we affect response, and I'll talk about that, plus what we do in recovery and how we affect the shorter and the longer-term recovery pieces of it, And then even after those immediate things are done, of course, mitigation comes full cycle and we go through it again. When we talk about it in terms of, again, the thread that permeates the fabric of emergency management in that pre-post disaster mitigation stage. In order to do that, I'd like to tell a story, and please forgive me, a number of people have heard this before, but I think it sets a proper stage. I was asked, while I was the state director of Iowa, to do a meeting with the metro mayors here in the Des Moines area a few years ago. And in that meeting, as is typical, you go to the meeting, you've got about 15 minutes to talk, and then about 15 minutes for questions. It was a dinner meeting. And so I asked what they wanted to know, and they said, well, if you had three things that you wanted to tell the mayors or wanted to know from mayors, what would it be? And I gave it some thought, and this is what I came up with. First thing I asked the mayors as we go through this is, do you know what the threats are to your area? Have you looked at the hazards identification and risk assessment that was part of the HIRA? We hadn't even talked about THIRAs yet, but have you looked at that? In addition, I wore the Homeland Security hat in my state, so I asked, have you included the terrorism threat in that look? Do you really know what the threats are? Have you looked at the studies? Have you gotten the information? Have you had the briefings? Have you talked to your emergency managers, your first responders? Do you know what the threats are? Because in most areas where there's a lot of information available, many people really don't know the threats they face on an everyday or on a continuing basis, both the large and the small. They don't have a good idea of the intelligence that's available to them. The next thing I ask the mayors is, if you know what the threats are, do you know what makes your community tick? Do you know about the communications infrastructure and the transportation infrastructure, the reliance on commerce and banking, the education systems? Do you know what makes your community tick? Do you know what you value the most? Do you understand the dependencies and the interdependencies? Do you understand the geographic context and the demographic context that you exist in, and what makes your community, and how you depend on others and others depend on you? That's very important. In most communities, most leaders, I would venture to say, really don't have an idea what makes things tick unless they've been around a considerable amount of time. And the reason that those two things are important gets me to the third issue, is now that you know what the threat is, you know what you value most and what makes your community tick, do you know what you're going to do to protect it? How are you going to set priorities? What you're going to do to mitigate actions? What you're going to do to protect critical infrastructure? And if you can't protect it, what you're going to do to insure against it, to make sure that it comes online quickly. If you know those things and you can walk through it, then you probably have a pretty good program. You're setting priorities for the limited resources you have, and you're able to move forward. That's what we talk about when we're talking about mitigation permeating the fabric of emergency management. It needs to be integrated into our formal process as well. And we're talking about the integration into the National Disaster Recovery Framework, the NDRF. Matter of fact, it even calls for a mitigation advisor. And what, again, we're looking for in that integration is exactly that, an integration in everything we do. We're also looking for a cross-integration with the federal community as we institute our programs and marry things together. The mitigation framework being drafted via Presidential Policy Directive 8 will align the nation and our stakeholders to come together sooner and more often to integrate mitigation, which gets to the next part of what we really want to talk about, and that we're the connector to whole community. You've heard Craig Fugate and others talk about whole community. It's not a new concept. It's one that we continue to build. But it's a realization that it takes the community working together to build back things better and stronger, and arguably it takes the community to set the priorities on what we're going to do to mitigate and reduce the loss of life and property in disasters. We really want to be stronger and better and more resilient in the face of the disasters that we face, whether they're human-caused, technologically caused, or caused by nature. It is a whole community approach in that it invites in not only the state and local and tribal governments along with the federal government, but it also reaches out to private sector, to non-governmental organizations. It reaches out across everything to make sure that our interests are there, that our values are projected forward, that we've come to conclusions as a community and how we're going to move forward. It requires investments by citizens, as individual citizens as part of their businesses, citizens as part of their governments, and investing in their representatives. It's going to require a joint investment to do it all, because the federal government isn't the only one that is going to be able to mitigate future actions. When we look at the mitigation issues and how they move forward, I think one of the things that I want to talk, as we put together the mitigation framework, and it's in the process of being vetted and the final comments and the final draft coming up now. But as we put forth the mitigation framework, one of the things that we wanted to talk about, as Director Fugate has talked about, is mitigation writ large. And the issue is this. When we talk about mitigation writ large, we really tap into that based on the Presidential Policy Directive, which defines it really as those efforts to reduce the loss of life and property in the face of a disaster. Well, that's very broad. There's a tendency to look at mitigation in the context of the Stafford Act and what FEMA executes and has charge for under federal law. We think that that's a narrow view, and again, we try to take the opportunity to take mitigative actions in everything we do. I think Tim Manning, who's the head of preparedness in FEMA, kind of said it best to us. What Tim talked about one day was really sitting down, and he says, you know, if we take effective mitigation measures, it affects how we prepare. And by that, he meant and went on to say that if we do mitigation, as we build capacities against what we're learning from our threat analysis, as we build those capacities, as we prepare, if we effectively mitigate, we may be able to redirect resources. We may have to adjust our capacities in a favorable way. It may extend the limited resources we have. It becomes part of our preparedness effort. It influences preparedness. Tim went on to say that it also affects how we respond. And I tell it as part of a response story that it's not traditional mitigation, but mitigation in the broader context. When we were doing the flood in 2008, we had a community that was losing its water resource. We had worked a couple days on trying to protect the water plant. We were losing it, and I was asked to call them in the morning to tell them that despite our best efforts, we thought that they were going to lose their water plant. Would they consider allowing the National Guard and the other team members to move downstream to protect other critical resources? And at the same time, we had a methodology we had learned from previous disasters on how to shut down the plant effectively to minimize the damage that would occur in the plant and would allow us to bring it up sooner once the waters had receded. So I gave them a call, and I asked them to get back to me in about 15 or 20 minutes. They actually called me back in about 5 and said, we agree. Please help us turn off the plant and do it effectively so we can turn it back on once the waters have receded, and please help other communities downstream and help to mitigate their losses by taking the protective measures there. Well, in my world, that's mitigation. In somebody else's world, it's part of disaster response or it's a protective action. Frankly, I'm not getting hung up on the definition. I'll go back to the president's definition, that when we look at mitigation writ large, we're talking about those efforts that minimize the loss to life and to property in the face of a disaster. So we've affected response. We also affected in that if we've mitigated it, we don't need to respond to it. So, again, we are able to redirect limited resources that we have and set different priorities as we affect response. As we go to recovery and we talk about mitigation writ large, we're looking for those opportunities in recovery to mitigate future actions, those improved standards that we may build to, relocation of a critical facility, how we will protect things in the future. There are a lot of community decisions to be made during the recovery process that allow us to mitigate and lessen the effects of future disasters. So when we talk about the mitigation framework, you're going to see it writ large. Now, all that said, the next part of that equation is, and my state hazard mitigation officer, when I worked for the state of Iowa, reminded me of this. He said, well, Dave, that's great that you're going to talk about mitigation that broadly. You'll even talk about it, about anticipating next disasters and how we incorporate things that we're learning even from climate change and other parts of the science that we learn. But the truth is, at the end of the day, the number one cause of damages in the United States is flooding. And the Stafford Act programs seem to orient themselves around flooding, or at least around natural disasters. So while you can talk about it writ large, what about the focus? Where are we going to focus our efforts? And my argument was, I agree with you that there needs to be focus on what affects us most, that there needs to be focus in flooding and in hurricane and in tidal surge and those things that affect us, but that that process should be part of what we discover about what threatens us the most, should be part about the data and the intelligence that we gather, and should be put in the context of what communities face every day as they set their priorities. So while we may have to focus on flooding as a major cause of disaster, it doesn't mean that we can afford to not discuss all the other threats we face, all the other things that we need to do to set priorities. And while the funding may focus in one area, it doesn't mean that we don't have the larger conversation and we have a talk about how we're going to invest in the future. The larger overarching mitigation questions, building codes and enforcement come to mind. A lot of us are working with that and working in it in a number of areas. We do a lot of work with the International Code Council and a number of other building groups that help establish the science of what we do. You'll note in the bullet it says Safe Alabama and Oklahoma Safe Room Initiative that may marry state money with individual investments for resilience. We're looking for that joint investment. Some of you may even go back to the James Lee Witt days and talk about Project Impact and the joint investment that happened there. But the truth is we're all investing in the future and what makes ourselves as individuals, our neighborhoods, and our communities more resilient. The continuity of mitigation efforts before and after a disaster, and engaging response, recovery, and preparedness, again, earlier in the process. I think one of the challenges for us is we tend to stovepipe a lot of what we do into the programs that we have. I think the renewed effort that we want in the federal government and the renewed effort we want in the whole community is really talking about how we marry programs together. There was a gentleman, his name is Ed Thomas, who was the federal coordinating officer for part of the disaster we had in 1993 in the Midwest. Ed talks today and has a certain amount of familiarity and is somewhat famous, but he talks about a patchwork quilt of putting programs together. I would call Ed a mentor of mine, and what I always remember was his ability to do that, to bring the federal partners together, to see how programs married together, to see how we could solve community problems. As we're looking at mitigation into the future, I want to go back, and even though we have some programmatic silos, I want to break some of those down as we can, as best we can, really talk about community problem solving, look at the problem we have in front of us comprehensively, and then ask the question, how does the funding apply, rather than asking the funding question up front and then what we can do to get the funding. We're really about community problem solving. Amy mentioned that you all have discussed the thyra that Doc Lumpkins was on. I know it's a confusing issue and we're walking through it. We're trying to take the whole thyra process, and it does influence grants and grants funding and a number of things that we're going through. But the attempt is to evolve it into one process. I tend to look at it this way, in that the thyra constitutes the intelligence. We collect a lot of data around the threats that we face, whether it's law enforcement data, other first responder data, public health data, weather data. We collect a lot of information. But it isn't until we do analysis that it really becomes intelligence. And the law enforcement community is used to how they analyze their data and actually use intelligence data to plot out their future moves. Other entities that are part of the whole community do the same thing. And I tend to think of thyra that way, that it's an intelligence gathering process. It's not a one-time process to get grant money, but it's an ongoing intelligence. We build upon it every day. It goes through a cycle, but the truth is you have to get in the right mindset to be doing it all the time. the HIRA, the one that you're used to doing with mitigation and mitigation planning, is actually in federal regulation, and it calls about the robustness of the HIRA. Again, in talking to this in the federal family, we begin to look at it and think of terms as the THIRA as a socket wrench. If you have the socket wrench, the THIRA becomes the socket wrench, but the individual sockets that you put on it are individualized to the task that you have on hand. So we may have the HIRA that drives the hazard mitigation planning and the stuff that we do to address natural hazards within the Stafford Act. We may have a law enforcement intelligence socket that we attach to the wrench when we're talking about terrorism and criminal investigations and what extremism may, how it may affect our communities and how we plan for that. So if we think about it, about that interchangeable piece, then the THIRA begins to take on another meaning in a broader context, and we can always talk about that as we move forward. But the point is at the end of the day, what we're really trying to do, go back to the mayor's story, is to better understand and communicate our risk to individuals so they understand the actions they can take. Again, we're in it together, and we have to address it together. There are actions and responsibilities that individuals need to take on, as well as their communities, as well as states and the federal government. We also want to educate the media about mitigation activities and really talk about the successes we have. You know, there used to be an ad for a chemical company called BASF. And BASF a number of years ago had is, we don't do this, we don't make this product, but we make these products better. Well, in mitigation, we like to talk about the same thing. We may not be the responders, we may not be the recovery, but we make all that better. We're part of the preparedness. We're part of everything that goes on. The other one was an old ad about mechanics, that you can pay me now or you can pay me later, but at the end of the day, it's much cheaper to pay me now than it is to incur the cost of a damaged vehicle. Well, the same thing holds true for mitigation. As we go forward, what we know is from the studies that have been done is mitigation pays for itself many times over. There are classic studies that say it's a 4-to-1 ratio. What we think is if we take up all the tangential relationships and the benefits of mitigation to society overall, the social economic impact, the environmental impacts, we think that mitigation is a healthy investment. It helps our communities to be resilient, it helps our communities grow, and it protects our citizens in the face of disaster. So that was the mitigation program. I want to spend the next couple seconds, or a few minutes, I guess, talking about the National Flood Insurance Program. The current authorization for the program ends tomorrow, May 31st. It's more than just insurance. It really links the risk analysis that we do as part of the ongoing program and assessment to mitigation, to floodplain management, and to insurance. And when we talk about that, the real talk about the NFIP is on the insurance side. But the truth is there's so many linkages to everything else we do that if the program isn't authorized, a lot of those activities that get paid through the federal insurance fund no longer happen. And we'll talk about that in just a second. It's something that every emergency manager needs to pay attention to. In so many of our communities, what's going on is the NFIP gets a little disconnected from emergency management, largely because it doesn't sit within the emergency management programs in many states. I know in my state, in Iowa, that the floodplain management program sits in the Department of Natural Resources. The insurance part of the program, of course, sits at the federal government, and even the state insurance commissioner doesn't have a large role to play in the National Flood Insurance Program. As is typical of emergency management agencies, when you're under-resourced and you don't have a role, you tend to set that piece aside and you think, well, it's somebody else's issue and we don't need to be as involved in emergency management. But I think if we really look at what the NFIP represents and how it invites community conversations and how we talk about risk and then how we insure against that risk because we can't mitigate all of it, then we begin to understand that connectedness and why the NFIP is important. key legislation has been considered in states that's put participation in the NFIP at risk. And what happens is we have states that look at how they do their code and code enforcement, how they institute state laws, the things that they want to exempt from the insurance program, and it's put them in danger of losing their participation. It's interesting to me when I pick up the news clippings every day, a lot of the discussions have to do with the flood maps that we do. And many of you have gone through, either have gone through map modernization or are now part of the risk map process. The truth is we're doing a couple things in the NFIP. We're trying to use, again, affordability as part of it, but the best science available to do the flood mapping. Where we're not precise or we've made errors, we're going to work with communities to try to correct those errors and do it before the publishing of the maps and put those out. But a lot of the discussion, the thing I see in clips, isn't about the risk that people face. It's frankly whether they need to buy insurance or not. We think the conversation really ought to be about the risk they face. Many of you that have been through flooding know that it doesn't stop at the lines that are drawn at the map. Matter of fact, a substantial part of the damages we receive are well outside the 100-year floodplain, or well outside that special flood hazard area that's delineated on a map. Getting communities to understand the risks they face, what they can do about those risks, how the NFIP is part of the broader mitigation strategy, I think is a better conversation, and it's a culture change that we're going to try to influence. If the NFIP lapses, a number of things happen. Number one, we can't sell new policies, nor can we modify existing policies. So that's the first thing that would happen. The next thing is since there is no program, we're limited to paying claims and covering our costs from the cash on hand. Before I left D.C. last week to attend the meeting in San Antonio, we had about $371 million in the fund at that time. Not a lot of money. What it means is if we had a major disaster while the program was not authorized, we would only be limited, again, to covering the cost up to that $371 million. We would no longer have borrowing authority from the Treasury, and we have some borrowing authority now where if we had a major disaster, we could go back to them. But we would lose that borrowing authority. It also means that in our communities, those that have a federally backed mortgage that live in a special flood hazard area required to buy flood insurance wouldn't have the ability to do that. So those closings on real estate would not happen. Matter of fact, the National Realtors Association anticipated that affects about 1,300 closings a day, about 40,000 closings a month. And it really stalls in many of our communities, that, especially those that are flood-prone real estate transactions. The current status, this really is moving quickly. Matter of fact, I anticipate some action on it today from the House. The House earlier this year passed a one-month extension before recessing. That was about 2 weeks ago. H.R. 5740 also included some provisions for reinsurance and other studies on privatization, really wanted to talk about how the private sector could enter the market and some studies on what that meant, what it would take for them to enter that market, what part of the market they may choose to enter, and what the effects would be on the program. Some of that study is already going on, but it really calls for that. And allowing financial institutions to accept private flood insurance. And right now, the federal program is the federal program, but remember the requirement that we talked about, that federally backed mortgages, if you're in a special flood hazard area, you have to buy flood insurance. This says that, in effect, you could get it from the private insurance side if it were available. So those things were called for in the House bill. Then last Thursday, the Senate passed a two-month extension, a 60-day extension, that includes permanent provision to phase out subsidies for non-primary residences. We're really talking about vacation homes and secondary residences that sit in a special flood hazard area, that they're going to lose their subsidy or the discount or the preferred rate that we give to others that live in special flood hazard area for a short period of time. So that's in the Senate bill. The House came back into session this week, and hopefully today, and everything that I'm reading today tells us they will take up the Senate bill. Matter of fact, I saw this morning they're going to suspend rules, try to take up the Senate bill without any amendment. It would require a favorable vote of at least two-thirds members present, and we'll see what happens today on that extension. Hopefully the House will pass it and we'll either to move forward. It's a short-term extension, and I want to talk about just a little bit of what we asked for before we go into the reform. I want to be clear, there have been a couple folks out there that well, let me back up. We did something this year that was really unusual. Craig Fugate, the FEMA administrator, wrote a letter to Congress expressing the urgency behind the reauthorization of the NFIP. We did it for a couple of reasons. One is, it really is the timing of it. We're at the beginning of hurricane season. We're at the traditional spring thaw and spring flooding season. A number of other things are coming up. It's our engagement with the Write Your Own Companies and how we work with the businesses to do the flood insurance program. So there was an urgency there. We didn't, of course, want to dissuade Congress from a discussion about reform. The House had passed a reform bill. The Senate was looking at their reform bill and pushing heavily to get floor time to debate it. But we wanted to weigh in and say, folks, you know, regardless of the discussion on reform, we really need reauthorization in order to move this forward more than we need anything else. And we want to allow the time to have the reform. We don't want to abandon the reform discussion, but we really need the reauthorization piece. When we talk to a number of our partners, the question is reauthorization or extension for how long? The extension that we asked for was 2 years to get us through the season, to put a number of options on the table, to have a robust discussion about reform and do meaningful reform in a piece, knowing that both, again, the House had passed their bill and the Senate was looking at theirs. The approach that we're taking right now is kind of a piecemeal approach. You saw a couple of the reform provisions in the Senate bill and the House bill that I already talked about. But we haven't seen anything comprehensive yet. I think the strategy that's being employed now may get us to a more comprehensive look at reform, and we'll talk about what that means. But my fear continues to be that we'll take a piecemeal approach to reform and not always understand or know the cause and effect of some of the actions that we're taking because we haven't taken the time to think it all the way through. We want to be able to take the time to think it all the way through and march it forward. But again, a series of short-term reauthorizations puts volatility in the program and puts it at risk. When we look at reform, we're really looking at this pyramid. We're looking at what some call in one arm of the pyramid. We're really talking about making the rates reflect the risk, what some will call actuarial soundness. That as we go out and we do the analysis, we collect the flood data, we do the updates of the maps, that the rates that we charge will lose their subsidy, that we'll really talk about a rate that reflects the risk, that we will be actuarially sound. We think that that's a good idea, that the rate that we have for a given area should reflect the risk that's there. There are a lot of discussions about what that means. We talk about the primary risk and the special flood hazard area, but we also talk about residual risk. We talk about the effects of dams and levees and what that means. There are a number of ways to parse out that discussion about actuarial soundness. The other thing we talk about when we do that is talk about affordability. Not necessarily the subsidies. Because the subsidy applies uniformly to properties that are within a certain area. But really about the affordability, about the people part of the program, people that are put in harm's way, perhaps not by their own design, sometimes through the improvement in the technology we apply, sometimes because that's where the available housing is. I know in my state often those that are least able to afford flood insurance that live in the lowest income housing live in some of the highest risk areas. So we have to talk about affordability. There's discussion about how we would reach that. Could we do a voucher system similar to what HUD does? There are a number of things that are in that discussion about affordability. The other part, the elephant in the room, and you've all probably read about it, is the $17.75 billion of debt that we incurred because of Hurricane Irene and Katrina, and what we're going to do about that debt. I don't know that that has an easy solution. We've been able to negotiate low interest rates on the debt that we have. We've been able to pay down some of the principal as well as the interest on the debt. But the truth is it continues to loom there. If we paid at the current rates, it would take us a number of years. And what staff, I think, is telling me is somewhere in the 30-year range to pay off the debt. The problem being, of course, is we've had pretty calm years relatively in disaster season and the drain on the flood insurance fund has been fairly minimal in the last few years. But if we had major disasters again or a number of small disasters tied together, we could drain the fund, have to go back and borrow more money, incur more debt. Somehow we have to get into a discussion of how we build the program, how we build in the solvency of the program. Now, some think that by charging actuarial rates, that'll help us to that solvency, and the truth is it may. The other part of that equation, though, is when we make the insurance reflect the rates it should based on the actuarial soundness, is that we'll actually lose policyholders. So the net effect would be a decrease of money in the funds. That's why this conversation is so critical as we go through it, that we find balance, that we're able to grow the program, that we're able to make it financially solvent, at the same time having rates that reflect the risk, and that we also talk about the affordability of the insurance that we have. The key initiatives and accomplishments overall for mitigation, again, the framework is open for comment. We did a listening session in January. The comments were due at the end of March. We're adjudicating those comments now, getting the final draft out. For those of you who are interested in how quickly we pay claims, we had about $1.6 billion in claims for Hurricane Irene and Lee in 2011. That's about 97% closed now, so we're getting those claims out. We try to do the bulk of our claims and move those in 30 days. We didn't quite make it in one of the hurricanes. We did make it in the other, but again, part of this is a capacity building issue with us and how we engage, frankly, the write your own insurance companies and the role that they play in giving us adjusters and making payments and getting through this system. It's another part of the program that we have to continue to talk about. We're providing more flexibility in how we do safe rooms, including allowing the cost for the development and value of land as an eligible cost in accordance with A87. The memo that we've issued also streamlines the review and operations and maintenance plan as part of our closeout, includes allowing costs for fire suppression, sprinklers, and HVAC systems. We're putting out a new wind retrofit policy that talks about the mitigation measures that we can take. Again, this is part of the building code stuff that we do and how we can do wind stuff and affect policies in our area. It's another one of our key initiatives. And then all I have is the background slide. So I'm going to go ahead and open it up to questions. Anybody's got anything, I'm willing to answer them.
Thank you very much, David. We'll get our instructions up here. One moment. All right. The main point is you need to put your question or comment in the Q&A panel, not in the chat panel, please. If you can't find the Q&A panel, you should be able to click on it up at the top right to open it up, and then you'll be able to type your question in. Please do keep your question or comment related to hazard mitigation or the NFIP, and reasonably concise. Once we have questions typed in, I will read, announce who the question's from. I'll read the question out loud, and then our guests will respond to it via the bridge. So, let's see. I will take one that accidentally got put into the chat before I got the instructions out. This is from Paul John, who asks, will FEMA consider a revolving fund program like the successful federal, state, clean water, and drinking water revolving fund for flood mitigation and adaptation for climate change?
We're talking about those issues. Can I say that we'll do it definitively? The answer is no, I can't. One of the things that we are talking about is, and you begin to hear these terms, is mitigation all the time. And I think that's important. Right now, the connotation of mitigation is it's really something that happens after the disaster. The bulk of the funds that many states receive to do mitigation really come through the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. And again, that gets turned on when in a Stafford Act declaration. The amount of money received is relative to the Stafford Act actions that are taken during the disaster. And even though it can be applied statewide and you can use it to mitigate a number of priorities, it has that post-disaster connotation. We want to go back to mitigation all the time. There is a little nuance, though, and we really talked about, or I've talked about, a revolving fund kind of program that really needs to be discussed further and vetted further. One of the things that concerns us, though, is this. If we pull mitigation and let it stand alone and look at those standalone programs that are out there, and we don't have the tie to the Stafford Act, that it makes it ripe for the picking for Congress. One of the problems that we have in many of our programs is how we obligate dollars and how long those dollars sit there before they're really acted upon and spent. And every time we see the gap between an allocation of dollars and an obligation of dollars and then the completion of projects, it calls into question the business reliability and viability of the program. So we need to address some of those issues as well. And over the next year, the hazard mitigation assistance people are going to look at their programs, what we can streamline, how we can do this better and obligate dollars. And again, part of the goal is to look at mitigation all the time. So a long answer to your precise question. So in summary, no, I can't say that we're going to do it, but I can tell you that it is something that we'll continue to discuss and look at. And if it becomes something viable that we can do, we'll certainly consider it.
And our next question is a direct segue, which is, can you comment from Shubha Srivastava, pardon me if I butcher your name, can you talk a little bit about plans for the pre-disaster mitigation program?
Yeah, PDM, you know, in the president's budget, PDM was zeroed out for next year. And again, partly because it was easy pickings. You know, the truth is, right now in the federal government, much like state and local governments, we're looking for areas that we need to cut money. Part of PDM and being pulled out of that is probably a multifold answer. One is, arguably, it wasn't a lot of money, although it was key in a number of states, and I've talked to local entities as well that really relied on PDM. But I think the other part of it is that what happened is we saw a lot of earmarks in the program, which always become questionable, and then a lot of unexpended money in the program. The other part of that thought was, as you look at PDM, is the planning part of what we do in pre-disaster mitigation could be picked up through HMGP and some of the other HMA programs that we have, could be picked up in the Emergency Management Performance Grant Program, or what will become the larger GPD program that's going on now that we're talking about. But we could pick up the planning components. What it left was the projects. And frankly, the projects caused me some concern. Again, what was left is doing a lot of projects with HMGP or FMA or severe repetitive loss or repetitive loss programs that were central to flooding. But we lost some of that multi-function that we did in PDM. it looks like Congresses, when they're doing their markups right now, are looking to put money back in PDM, although it's not a large amount of money, but put money back in the program. For us, I think we need to have, again, that ongoing conversation of how do we make mitigation happen all the time, how do we invest, how do we allocate dollars, and then how do we execute those dollars to make sure we don't put programs at risk. It needs to be part of that broader conversation.
Folks, we don't have any more questions on the queue. If you have one, please go ahead and type it into the Q&A panel, and we'll get to it. David, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the severe repetitive loss program. How are the buyouts going nationally?
I think the buyouts are going well. I think part of the problem, though, in buyouts, and we've experienced in all the states, are the time to get there. And the time, again, it really is part of this whole community dynamic. One of the things that we want to capture is states and local governments that have prepared well are able to accelerate that process. And we saw that happen in New Jersey after Hurricane Irene the hurricanes that happened last year. And they did their process in a couple of months. In visiting with the folks in New Jersey, in visiting with the FEMA region, and talking to them, a lot of that was the pre-work, was a result of the pre-work that they had done in identifying projects, identifying opportunities, knowing where they wanted to do this. There had been some disasters in the past. They knew which properties they really wanted to make the offer to. They were really able to pull the trigger much faster. Again, as we go in and we influence the National Disaster Recovery Framework, we look at recovery planning, we look at mitigation planning, I think communities that position themselves well are more able to take care of the property acquisition piece of what we're able to do in mitigation. So we can make that program better. The other part of that is as we do it and we elongate it, people are worried about match and those things. This gets into marrying programs together. It often happens in the name of disaster, but it's not an automatic. I know in my state, especially in the larger disasters, we really pressed economic development and others to come up with money. In our state, the Economic Development Agency did it through the Community Development Block Grant Funding. So you're pressing the federal government to be able to use CDBG money as the match. And then we went a step further. We not only wanted to use it for match, but for properties that didn't qualify under HMGP, we actually did property acquisitions just using Community Development Block Grant money. There are a number of ways of getting there. And the point is communities should strategize and look at these issues now, both in identifying properties they may want to acquire, how the programs may fold in, where they're going to come up from match. It becomes part of that pre-recovery planning process rather than waiting to do it at the time of the disaster.
How about the flood mapping progress? How is that going, the modernization or the risk map? Maybe perhaps you could just give us a little background on that risk map.
Yeah, when I came aboard, I came aboard last September. One of the things that came to my attention, and frankly as a state director I didn't realize it, is that the risk map program had taken a substantial cut. It looked like we're going to take another small hit this year if the president's budget prevails. We want to look at it as an investment. One of the discussions that we're really having is how do we use risk map as part of that intelligence gathering process? And I say part of it because it's not all of it. It is part of the community discussion. So while we may lose some of the financial resources we have to do with risk map, what we don't want to compromise is the preciseness of the maps that we have and our ability to have community conversations about the risk that a community faces. Again, it's that interaction with the community that makes the maps more precise, that allows us to adjust them as we go on. But it's an opportunity to have a discussion about risk overall and how that plays in to the dynamic of the community. in FEMA, we're talking about how we invest in that and how we use that as a basis for discussion. One of the things we talked about in a recent meeting with FEMA and how we collaborate internally is going out and using the risk map for part of that broader community conversation about emergency management, about recovery planning, about the HIRA, not just the risk map, but actually talking about the THIRA and how that folds in, and that the risk map process becomes part of that. There's a lot of discussion going on. I wish we were doing more miles of maps. I wish we were getting out to more communities. We've had to move our projects and delay them a little bit because of the reductions in funding. But we're going to continue to move forward. We want to continue to move forward with a quality project, and we want to really involve community conversation in risk and risk management.
I have another question that I got entered into the chat from Liz Milner, and she asks, what can be done to educate stakeholders and the community at large on the importance of disaster mitigation?
What I think is it really becomes a value proposition. And that's why I go back and I often tell the mayor's story. Is if I'm the mayor of a community or I'm a county supervisor or county commissioner or wherever I am, what I'm looking at is values for the dollars that I'm investing. And what I'm interested in is some analysis. I've got to have some context of making those investments. And that's why we talk about the THIRA. You know, frankly, there are some folks that are a little afraid of the THIRA. They say when you add the terrorism component in, it skews the data and the statistic. How do I do an unknown like a terrorist event that could have a huge impact? How do I compare that to the other natural hazards things that we normally did through the HIRA and then make decisions? And the truth is we don't always have all the knowledge we need about what we face as dangers. But the more that we collect, the more data and intelligence that we have, the more we know about the threats, the better decisions we're able to make, the better informed decisions we're able to make. Too often our community officials don't look at that data. They don't know what the risks are that they face. They don't know the probability of occurrence. They don't know what the impact will be if it does occur. They may not even have, some of them, a strong sense of the history of their community and what they've faced in the past. And all that needs to be developed into that certain intelligence about what goes on. The other part of the value proposition, again, is really about what makes your community tick and what things you cannot live without in the short term or even the longer term. What are those things that if you lost them, your community would be devastated? It may not be able to recover. It wouldn't rebuild to the level that it was before. It may lose its tax base. It may lose its viability. It may lose businesses. You really have to have those kinds of discussions with your community leaders. It even goes down to the neighborhoods. Some people see, for instance, the flood insurance program as a burden. And again, cost can be a part of that. I certainly understand that. But many don't see it as an opportunity. Here's a chance to protect that thing in your life that is most important to you, and for many of us, it's our most major investment, our home. Here's an opportunity to protect that, knowing that it may be in harm's way. And yet, we often don't take those opportunities. It's really having that, again, that community conversation at all levels. Is what risk do we think we can afford? How are we going to cover that risk? Are there opportunities to mitigate it? What's the return on those dollars? What happens if we lose those important parts of our community and the return on that? There are a number of studies out there that talk about the return on the investment. But I think as we talk to our community leaders, it's really trying to put it into that value judgment that says, guys, this is why we do it. It allows our community to survive. It brings back our community when we face a disaster. It'll make us more resilient. And again, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to pay it up front than it is to recover from it at the back end.
Are you looking at doing anything more with the best practices type examples, David?
Yeah, we are. Not just for mitigation, but in FEMA overall. One of the things that I really want to be able to capture is rather than documenting the lessons that we learned and have lessons documented, we really want to get into learning from them and how we train and articulate that message and how we walk through those issues. Again, it's a continuous effort. It has to do with the involvement of the community and how we get out and inform officials. You know, I think we've done some work in there. You have the LLIS and others that are looking at lessons learned. We've been able to capture some of them. We post things on websites. People share information. But again, it's often lessons documented but not real lessons learned. It also means engaging the academic community and others about what they're learning from their research. We had a discussion recently in FEMA is, do we even know the body of work that's going on in there and what we can learn from it? Everything from building sciences to what we're learning about weather and climate change. What are we learning that allows us to invoke best practices and how do we share that? It's interesting, even some of the smaller conversations we have. I had one recently that says if we adopt building codes and standards for earthquake protection, if we did that uniformly in many of our areas, it also helps protect us against explosions and bombing, makes our buildings more resilient. It's sharing all of that information and data, and there's a lot of it out there, and making it, again, not just the documentation, but making it easier to find it, easier to apply it, talking about our successes and the lessons that we learned and moving from lessons documented into a real learning environment.
We have a couple questions left I think we can get to quickly. Marianne Luer asked, she said, you previously acknowledged while still in Iowa that it was difficult to comprehensively evaluate land use and encourage meaningful long-term mitigation, in part because there was no state office of planning and decision-making was distributed with some functions going to EM, DNR, economic development, et cetera, with no one entity looking at everything comprehensively. Now, here we get to the question. Do you think anything can be done at the federal level to encourage comprehensive, cross-disciplinary, cross-agency, et cetera, thinking about hazards, both at the state and local level?
At the federal level, that's part of what we're going through now. You know, it's interesting to come to FEMA after being a state director for so long, and you think you know what FEMA is about. And I was asked once what the biggest change was, and it was the largeness of FEMA that I found most interesting. Of the things that we were involved in, and the communities we were engaged in, and the cross discussions we had with a number of federal agencies. As an example, one of the things that I now co-chair with the Corps of Engineers is a group called, love acronyms, FIFMTIF, the Federal Interagency Floodplain Management Task Force. Now, it's about floodplain management, but it involves a number of the federal agencies, FEMA, the Corps of Engineers, Department of Interior, the Council of Environmental Quality, the Department of Defense. There's a number of HUD, there are a number of partners in the room, and we're really talking about good floodplain management practices, the consideration of how we move forward, and can we move forward in a concerted way? Can we adopt, again, some rules of the road in how we look at floodplain and floodplain management? And that's just an example of those conversations that need to go on. We're also using the establishment of the disaster mitigation framework or the national mitigation framework as part of that discussion. And I'll go back and put my state hat on just for a minute. When I was the state director, I'd been here for a number of years, and I was talking to the economic development director at the time. And we recall when there was an office of program policy, OPPD, Office of Program Policy and Development, I think, in the state of Iowa. And in the 70s, those offices in many states were dissolved. And you're right, the budget function of that and that interagency piece probably went to a Department of Management or a Department of Budget. Some of the other things went to Department of Natural Resources, some to Emergency Management. Economic Development offices were stood up. And unless you have strong direction from a governor or a mayor or those, you don't often get those people in the same room together unless there's a disaster to have the discussions prior to an event about how they're going to invest and how they're going to do that. You tend to work in the stovepipes that you have for your programs, and you really don't talk about marrying them together in some comprehensive way. It really takes a strong policy office to do that with some authority to be able to move forward comprehensively. That's the whole community conversation that we want to have. It's not a prescriptive thing about how they recreate offices and how they do that. It really is an encouragement for community leaders to say, you need to get these people in the room. They all have an interest. They'll come at it from a different view. They won't always agree, and that's okay. You still have to have the discussion. You still need to make community discussions. You really need to talk about the cause and effect of your programs and the influences that they have and how we look to the future. At the end of the day, I don't know of very many communities that don't want to become more resilient and don't want to make their citizens safer. So that's the goal, and we all have the common goal. Now we have to sit down and have the conversation and move forward comprehensively.
I think on that note, that's a good note to wrap it up on for today. Thank you very much, David. Once again, we very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. We know you face enormous challenges in your new job, and we wish you every success as you move forward to face them.
Thank you, Amy, and thanks to all of you out there that tuned in today. Again, none of us does this alone. It really is about the communities that we have and how we interact. I thank you for everything that you do in your communities and your ability to move these conversations forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, folks, before you go, please do take a moment just to fill out our little form here. Again, if you're not on our mailing list, you can go to our homepage, and there's a place on the left-hand side where you can subscribe. And if you subscribe to the list, when today's recordings are available, you will get a notice, and you will get links to the materials. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Our next program will be on June 13th, so please plan to join us then. And until then, thanks to everyone for participating today. Have a great afternoon, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.